Thanks for coming along tonight. It's good to have some people back in our room here at 47 Phillip Street, but good also to be able to make contact with our good friends and supporters outside of Sydney and the various capital cities and regional areas of Australia who are in on the call. We'll be taking questions and discussion from both. Now, both our speakers will talk for about 15 minutes each, and we'll have 30 minutes of question discussion and finish within 60 minutes of the start. Our speakers are well known, so I'll introduce them briefly. Well known for their writing in particular, but also for appearances on television, in particular on Sky News, I think. So Aaron Patrick, we'll lead off with Aaron, senior correspondent for the Australian Financial Review, is the author of four books, and he's spoken here, or four books on Australian politics, or on politics, and he's spoken here on a number of those books. Parnell McGuinness is Managing Director, Strategy and Policy at Agenda C, and she's a columnist for the Sydney Morning Herald and The Age, and for the Sun Herald. And the topic tonight is Australian Politics 2020, an update, and we're going to start off with Aaron Patrick, then we go to Parnell McGuinness, and then to questions and discussion. Welcome, Aaron. Can I ask you to turn your phones off?
Thank you, Jared, and thank you, everyone, for coming along tonight. Some old faces and some new faces, and welcome to everyone out there watching over the internet. Sorry you can't be here with us tonight in central Sydney. I'm the warm-up act for Parnell, so I'm going to keep it reasonably brief so she can dazzle you with her amazing language. I'm more of a writer than a speaker, so please forgive me for my for being inarticulate at various times, which no doubt I will be. I want to make some introductory remarks about the current political situation, and then I want to give you a little bit of a preview. I've just written a book, I'm almost finishing a book about Malcolm Turnbull, which will be out in a few months. Editors, the god of editing, notwithstanding. And so after I've just discussed what I see as the current political situation, I'll talk a little bit about what I'm going to write in my book. The key question at the moment is, why is the coalition government losing? Now, clearly it's behind our news poll. There's been some other seat-by-seat polls in the inner city areas which are showing reasonably big shifts to the independents, including in North Sydney and Wentworth, which is not too far away. Now, the answer is not as obvious as it seems, because objectively, Australians are in a pretty good spot. House prices are high. Unemployment is the lowest it's been since the 1970s. We've had a pretty good pandemic. I know we like to complain a lot here in Australia, but very few people have died. And hospital numbers are tracking well below the worst forecasts. In fact, they're travelling below the best forecasts. We have spent a lot of money, but apart from, I think, a massive budget blowout, we've had a really good pandemic. Despite what you read in the headlines, there hasn't been any massive governance failures of this federal government. There hasn't been any cabinet-level corruption or massive examples of incompetence. Nonetheless, we are in a situation where the government is well behind, and if things don't turn around for them, they will probably lose power. And so what's going on here? Well, there's a few elements, and I think the most obvious one, the most interesting one, is the Prime Minister, Scott Morrison, the man who emblemises the entire government. So I think there is a real sense of growing scepticism about Mr. Morrison out in the community. I was speaking to a senator in Canberra today, a Conservative senator, and I said, look, how do Conservatives feel about the Prime Minister? You know, are they disappointed with him? And he said, listen, I'm still a believer, but it's really hard because I get out there in the electorate and people say to me, why should I vote for the coalition? And they say, you've racked up a lot of debt. You're supporting lockdowns in Western Australia. You're rolling back what we thought were going to be religious protections. You haven't done anything on 18C. You're providing more money to the ABC. So why should we be voting for you? And the senator says, well, I tell them, well, we're not as bad as the other blokes. Now, that's not a compelling reason to vote for a political party. So the danger with the coalition is that their base, that they are losing their base. Now, the extent of this is obviously very hard to tell, impossible to tell from anecdotal evidence. But it's so widespread, and I think you also detect, and I'm detecting, a current of scepticism or hedging creeping into the Murdoch press too and on Sky News. You see people like Andrew Bolt getting stuck into the Prime Minister. Obviously, Janet Albrightson's been a long-term sceptic. These people out on the right, particularly people of a libertarian bent, but also some more traditional social conservatives, are a bit sceptical about the Prime Minister. And this, for me, is elite opinion, but I'd be surprised if that wasn't reflective of a broader disillusionment with the Prime Minister amongst Conservative voters. Now, clearly we all know the Prime Minister is a great campaigner, and what he and the Liberal Party's focused on is not the right or the far left, it's the centre. And that's where he's skilled at. And that's why he is announcing more money for the ABC, because he's trying to cauterise these swing voters. He's trying to cauterise disenchantment in the middle against him. His problem is, though, that he cemented his reputation as an election winner in 2019. But that's when we didn't know him. The country was starting to get to know him. The country didn't really know who he was. It didn't know what he stood for. And that day where he stood in the Horizon Church down in the Sutherland Shire and prayed with his arms in the air was a pivotal moment in the definition of who Scott Morrison is. Because at that point, none of us who are alive today had ever lived under an evangelical Christian Prime Minister. And that was a moment where Australians wondered, wow, this is a new kind of politician for us. This is a new kind of top political leader. And that helped him, I think, get across the line, even though the number of Pentecostals in Australia is very small. It's probably only less than 2%. Now, Scott Morrison's religious beliefs aren't really of great import. We're used to them. They aren't a particularly significant part of his government or the way he is governed. What we have is a man who is pragmatic, who governs for the centre. And the problem with that, while it can be great at winning votes, is that it creates an impression that you don't stand for anything or you're not a particularly strong believer in certain values, which is something you could not say of Tony Abbott, of John Howard, of Paul Keating, perhaps John Howard, Malcolm Fraser, Julia Gillard. All these leaders had this great skill of triggering intense support and loyalty amongst certain groups in society. To me, Morrison's weakness, which is the flip side of his strength, is his inoffensiveness. Because Morrison is so much of a suburban, easygoing, middle-of-the-road guy that he doesn't electrify any elements of his base. And that, I think, is his real problem. And you have got, here in New South Wales, you've also got a really pissed off Liberal Party. So we've got this bizarre situation where 4 months before a federal election, there's no Liberal Party Senate ticket, there's no endorsed Liberal Party candidate for North Sydney, for Farrer, for Mitchell.
Not North Sydney.
No, Trent Zimmerman has not been endorsed in North Sydney. So Trent Zimmerman cannot go around and campaign in North Sydney where I live and saying, I'm your candidate. Okay. In Hughes, which was held by Craig Kelly, we have a potential candidate right in the room here, which is Alex Cook, who came along today. You want to put your hand up, Alex, so everyone knows who you are. Now, Alex is a prominent member in the Liberal Party out there. I gather there's about 100 members in Hughes. That's a really important seat for the Liberal Party to win back. And under the Liberal Party constitution, there should be a vote of local members for Alex and his contenders and the other contenders. At the moment, you have an arrangement where the faction leaders want to impose Alex Dorr, who lives in Manly, to go out and live in the western suburbs. Sorry, to go and represent the western suburbs. Now, I don't want to besmirch Alex Dorr. I'm sure he'd be a great member of parliament. But at the same time, How can a political party look its members in the face and say, we want you to come out there, give us your money, give us your time, give us your blood, sweat and tears, but you can't have a say on who your local representative is? That for me is such a strong internal contradiction that what's going on at the moment is really damaging to the morale in the Liberal Party. And the irony of it being is that it does seem to come back to the Prime Minister, who himself was the state director of the Liberal Party, who should know better than anyone the importance of internal party democracy. And that's because Scott Morrison's lieutenant, I call him, is Alex Hawke, who's the member for Mitchell, who's the head of the centre-right faction, which is Scott Morrison's faction. And if you believe all the accounts, these books written at the last election, including mine, it was the centre-right who were the flipping voting bloc, which very cleverly allowed Turnbull to seduce Turnbull into thinking he had a chance of winning against Dutton, gave Dutton enough votes to destroy Turnbull's credibility, and then flipped to Morrison to make him Prime Minister. So we have Alex Hawke is able to quite cleverly hold up the whole pre-selections in New South Wales, because to be a candidate, you have to be vetted. And it takes 15 minutes. And I ask you, do you have a criminal record? Did anyone take an AVO out against you? Do you owe money? Are you a problem gambler? And this takes 15 minutes, apparently. But it's an important job. And there are four people on the committee who do this. One of them is the president of the Liberal Party of New South Wales, Philip Ruddock. Another one is Alex Hawke. But Alex Hawke hasn't turned up to any of them, so they haven't been able to hold them. And who and what is one of the seats covered by this? Alex Hawke's seat. So Alex Hawke is meant to be vetting the person who is standing against him seeking a vote of members in the seat of Mitchell, a guy called Michael Abrahams. So I guess what I'm saying is, as a political party, you need to set, why does this need to be said? But you need to set a good example. Okay? If you want the community to come and vote for you and make you and allow you the privilege of running the country, then I think it's pretty important that you demonstrate to them that you are prepared to abide by democratic decisions of your own membership. So it's little things like that which I think are undermining, contributing to the disillusionment in the community with Morrison. Okay. Now, if you want the coalition to win, there is good news. Whenever we talk about these things, we generally talk, whenever we make political observations, they're generally static. They refer to a particular point in time. And so that's why political punditry can be so incredibly out of date within 2 to 3 months, as I've discovered as I've gone back and read, and when I went back and I read some of the, even the conservative pundits predicting a shortened victory before the 2019 election. Next month, we have a federal budget. And this budget is the time when the government completely can reframe the whole political debate. They can change the whole perception of what this election is about. Because at the moment, there are no great differences between the two major political parties. There's no huge differences on IR. There's no huge differences on climate. They both want net zero by 2050. There's no huge differences on foreign policy. There are no huge differences on health or pandemic response. Now, there's some around the margins, but in general, the division between the two parties at the moment is one of perceptions of management capability. The budget will change that, because Josh Frydenberg and Scott Morrison are going to throw every cent they can at winning this election. They will not die trying, okay? And they will, and I don't know what it is, but you can see Josh Frydenberg was out there today saying that you can't trust Labor on the economy. And this to me is preparing the ground for a scare campaign, a massive scare campaign to worry the middle ground, the self-funded retirees. It'll be people who are vulnerable to this kind of concerns about Labor economic management. And presumably they're going to argue that you can't trust taxes not to go up under Labor. Now, one of the ironies being is the taxes are going to go up at some point because we have $1 trillion in debt and someone's going to have to pay for it. So maybe we won't have to pay those higher taxes, but eventually some Australians are going to have to pay that. So in that sense, in an intellectual sense, the argument that one side of politics is going to raise taxes actually stands up. Unfortunately, it'll have to be both sides, but there is some weight behind that scare campaign, which I think is coming. We will have a March budget, and then we will have 2 months flat out run to the election, maybe 6 weeks. It's going to be a fascinating race. I'm not going to predict who will win because I've got absolutely no idea, but it's going to be fascinating nonetheless. Parnell, over to you.
So we go to Parnell McGuinness. Yeah.
Can I just reiterate what he said? I'm a writer, not a speaker, really, so you do have to bear with me. But first of all, I just want to say thank you to Jared and Anne for having this here, and it's amazing to have a real audience again. It's so exciting. I love that we kind of didn't plan this, but our pieces fit together. So you asked the question, why is the coalition losing? And my piece is basically a review on the predictions I made last year about why the coalition would be in the situation it is now. So I'm going to spend the next few minutes telling you why I was right. So first of all, last year I predicted to start with that it's really dangerous to make political predictions and we should stick to observations on prevailing currents. So I just want to say that I predicted that predicting stuff is a really bad idea and I was right on that. But secondly, I said that Australians wouldn't be champing at the bit to see international borders reopen and that Morrison would therefore move cautiously, erring on the side of keeping things closed until after the election to stay in alignment with the opinion polls. Now that one's been confirmed. The international border is finally scheduled to open on the 21st of February, but the polls suggest that Australians weren't in any hurry on that. So domestically, Morrison has been following the polls again, and he's met the moment on WA, as the Sussexes say, met the moment, I love that language, and lent his support to Premier McGowan's indefinite border closures. So he's always sort of on the back foot behind the polls, and that's something people have noticed. And while they might think that they want things, they don't necessarily like it when they get it. So the next one was I predicted that the energetic reform agenda that was being led by the New South Wales state government, especially Treasury, would make the reform-leery federal government look weak and unimaginative. This one's, of course, quite subjective. It depends whether you think that reform is necessary or good. And of course, it isn't always either. But it is also a fact that many of the existing settings are only the way they are because people couldn't get the policy that they wanted through. So there's always a dial to twiddle to improve things. And while there's no utopia that we can achieve with perfect policy, there's always a good argument for reforms which inch things forward in the right direction. So last year I pointed out that the Prime Minister's 2020 zeal to shift the dial, as the Productivity Commission report proposed in 2015, had faded away, and the Commission's report had been relegated back onto the shelf to gather dust. So to my mind, Canberra was left looking feeble as Sydney marched determinedly forward. But then, of course, the New South Wales Premier resigned, pending the outcome of an ICAC trial, and the reformist Treasurer became Premier. Now, as Treasurer, his priorities have been more exalted than they were as Treasurer, and he's been able to pretend to keep the virus at bay, and therefore has had less time between shamanistic press conferences to propose reforms. So a lot of the competition has evaporated, but Morrison is still left in a position of looking like he doesn't have a great economic reforming plan. Which brings us to my next prediction. I predicted that Morrison's lack of reform achievements would leave him looking like he lacks vision. Again, this one's sort of subjective, but if it's untrue, then there is at least a common hallucination shared by people in the policy space that this is the case. And it might depend what qualifies as a vision. So maintaining a glorious status quo could be said to be a vision. A week out from the 2019 election, Morrison tweeted that It is my vision for this country as your Prime Minister to keep the promise of Australia to all Australians. What's the promise of Australia? That wasn't made clear. But Morrison never faltered. The promise is the vibe of the thing, as far as Morrison is concerned. And his election campaign focused on how good Australia was just as he found it. And as Australia's favourite saying goes, if it ain't broke, don't fix it. It could be argued that this was a perfectly adequate vision for a Conservative. Or it could be argued that it's the slippery slope to complacency, stagnation, and the sclerosis that economist Mansour Olson warned of, which entrenches rent-seeking behaviour and hobbles innovation in the wider economy. But then there's also the issue of the way that political capital works, and this is something that Keating and Howard understood. Political capital is essentially an accumulation of trust and goodwill in the government by the public, and in the leader by the public and the party room. And for the Paul Keating thought about political capital as something that was to be accumulated and spent on important reforms. But Howard realised a deeper truth, which I've spoken to him about. He's quite interesting on this subject. He realised that political capital isn't so much to be spent as invested. An important reform requires an accumulation of political capital, but demonstrating that you care enough about a matter to sink political capital into it sends a message to the electorate that you stand for something and creates a platform to campaign on at the next election. And one of the difficulties Morrison now faces as his election approaches is that he doesn't have this type of demonstration of vision and belief. Fairly or unfairly, the low death rate in Australia, which Aaron alluded to, has become table stakes, and he's blamed for what has gone wrong in that process as opposed to celebrated for what has gone right. And I think that that was entirely predictable. I think governments are elected to manage tricky situations and to still chart a course based on conviction. And because Morrison's conviction is that Australia should be as it always was, his problem is that it now isn't because of the pandemic. If he had at least one signature reform, let's say renovating the tax mix, which he championed at a time when he was riding high in the polls, his personal popularity might never have fallen to where it is now. He'd have something to point to that was undeniably an achievement, above and beyond shutting the gates of an island nation to keep out a virus. And he would have done something that at least earned him respect, which is more valuable at an election than popularity. And that goes to the second half of the prediction that I made last year, which was that the government would burn up all of its good news stories, patting itself on the back, and leave itself without the type of good news stories a government needs in the lead up to an election. I was right again. This has always been a bad habit of this government. Back in 2020, it was celebrating the success of the COVIDSafe app, which was downloaded by over 6 million people, including by me three times, to up the stats because apparently reopening depended on it, but identified in the end only a very few cases. Other good news stories to run into in 2020 included why Greg Hunt gave up running for a while, which celebrated the Health Minister's heroics in saving Australia from the pandemic by answering his text messages. There were two problems with running these stories so early in the pandemic and so far away from the election. The first is that they reeked of complacency and backpatting, which probably did more harm than good. When people are anxious, the last thing they want is a smug government congratulating itself. The second problem is that now that the election's approaching, those stories can't be published again. They're old news now. So the government has nothing up its sleeve to push the stories it doesn't like off the front page and remind voters that they were really rather pleased with the government at the time. Almost as pleased as the government was with itself. Prediction six. I said that opposition leader Anthony Albanese would be relishing the prospect of a Work Choices 2.0 fight ahead of this election. Okay, I got this one wrong. So, an eviscerated industrial relations bill passed the Senate in May last year, removing Work Choices as an election issue but also putting to death the last of Morrison's claims to having made a policy change during his time in government. Instead, Albanese is benefiting from the late push on the cultural issues, which the government had hoped would shore up politically disengaged Conservatives ahead of polling day. For instance, today on the religious discrimination bill. I'll talk a little bit more about that later. So my next one was that the publication of the intergenerational report would cause strife between the generations. I was just wrong on that, and I don't know why. Baby boomers must be better at spin. And that there'd be pressure to raise the New Start payment after recipients had been on the higher job seeker rate during the pandemic. Look, I'm surprised that this one's disappeared off the agenda as quickly as it did. The government raised the rate $50 a fortnight and effectively negated the issue. It shows to me that Albanese's discipline is in opposition is quite incredible, that he has is so determined to make himself a small target that he's persuaded his party room to do so, and the institutions which would normally have banged on about this a bit more. So he has really shrunk this as an issue. So six out of eight predictions were pretty much right. I reckon that's an okay record. And I also made a couple of observations that I think are worth revisiting. One was that it would be a historic missed opportunity if the government were to have the first Indigenous minister for Indigenous Australians and not empower that minister to deliver something important. Now, a couple of months out from an election, and in the second last week of Parliament, we can definitely say that nothing historic will be delivered in this area, which is a shame. I suggested that Tony Abbott, who was shown long-term genuine interest in this Indigenous space, could be given a role in facilitating this important thing, whatever it was, by helping to develop a Conservative-led solution to reconciliation. Abbott's written and said some interesting things this year, but it doesn't seem like anyone thought to ask him for assistance or considered how he might be leveraged in that space. And I propose that Morrison might find a way to use Abbott to champion culture wars causes, which his government could then step in and solve. This is one of the ways that you do things in this space. You let somebody else create the problem so that you can come and solve it, but you also don't get the blame for it going in the media. So the blowback goes against the organisation proposing as opposed to the organisation solving. Little media lesson for the government if they're watching. And I proposed, and instead they appear to have chosen to go it alone on the religious discrimination bill, the school curriculum and the freedom of speech in universities. And now while you guys might remember that last one, I can guarantee you the electorate won't. Because they chose to go it alone, they're now caught in the worst of all culture wars to have right before an election. The tricky question of how not to discriminate against homosexual or transgender children while allowing religious schools to still discourage the kind of environment that has led to one Sydney school reportedly having as many as a quarter of its students identifying as gender fluid. Many issues don't cut through to the public, but that one will. All of this puts the government in a very tricky position in an election year. Election years are always tricky, of course, for many reasons. Among other things, because the media becomes obsessed with campaign tactics, which are infinitely more entertaining to write about than issues of substance. As one disenchanted Liberal once said to me, every journo fancies themselves a campaign director, but very few enviously look at the slog of policy development. I think that's a bit unfair. But there's definitely a beltway echo chamber between the readers and the writers of Twitter and traditional media, which favours stories about text messages over stories about highly complex matters like foreign policy and a changing world. And so that's more or less how I think the coalition is losing the election, because of all of these things that it did or did not do, more importantly, over the last couple of years. Most dangerous for the government right now is the notion that it has no courage and no conviction, and that that's taken hold among its most politically engaged traditional supporters. Ahead of the 2013 election, in which, after the Rudd-Gillard-Rudd years, a lot of my Labor friends said to me that they were planning to vote Liberal for the first time in their lives. It was at that point they were disgusted. This year, I'm hearing from a lot of Liberals that they feel taken for granted and disappointed with Morrison. Most aren't talking about voting Labor. Many are talking about strategically voting to send the Liberal Party a message. but a few are insisting that the only way to send a message loudly enough to be heard is to vote the party out. This is not, of course, the sort of discussion that's happening around the barbecue in the Burbs, but the Burbs is not happy with Morrison either, from what I'm picking up. They might not know who Albanese is, but they know they think Morrison is a bit of a dick. I can say that here, right? The idea that Morrison is all about the photo op and is not working tirelessly to improve the nation has cut through. And the priorities of the electorate have also shifted during the pandemic in a way that doesn't favour traditional Liberal strengths. Health is a much bigger issue than it's been in the past, along with the cost of living, which is showing up in polling as a growing concern. The RBA has indicated there won't be an interest rate rise before the election, but people can feel one coming and might just price it into their judgment on the government. Nonetheless, I don't believe the election is yet in the bag for Labor. One reason for this is the phenomenon that we might call the ScoMo effect. Morrison has this knack for turning off voters when he's front and centre of the public eye now, but as soon as other people criticise him, people get all defensive about him. It's a really interesting notion. How do you run an election campaign in which the Prime Minister is not front and centre, but the criticisms of him are? What an interesting campaign that would be to watch. Anyway, enough speculation. I think my gloating has come to an end. And of course, it's all science fiction until it is proven to be historical fact. Thank you very much.
Many thanks to Parnell and many thanks to Patrick. So we come into questions and discussion. I thought I'd lead off briefly with two brief questions. We get brief answers from you two, then we go to the rest. So I'll just start off with Aaron. You mentioned your book about Malcolm Turnbull. Can you give us a brief preview?
Thanks, Jerry, for giving me the opportunity to pick up on what I forgot to tell you about before. So I've written a book, which is with the publishers now, and it examines Malcolm Turnbull's relationship with the Morrison government and essentially how has he conducted himself since he was removed as Prime Minister in 2018. And part of the reason I decided to write this book was I wanted to write about what had been happening in politics over the last couple of years. And I thought the problem is that I didn't think there would be that great an interest in a biography of Scott Morrison. I didn't think he would be as interesting or compelling a character as Turnbull. Because Turnbull, in his behaviour after he left office, has shown such remarkable vindictiveness. And for such an accomplished man, that I thought, this is a, what a compelling story this is. So in the book, I try and explain what Malcolm's done and why he's done it. And I don't want to spoil the punchline, but it might be given away by the title, which I think will be Revenge, if the lawyers will let us use that.
Thanks, Aaron. Parnell, you're pretty tough on the Prime Minister, but if you look at the polls, and the polls may be wrong, but he still holds out reasonably well and preferred Prime Minister reasonably. He's still reasonably popular, in spite of all the difficulties of the last, particularly of the last 2 or 3 months. So you end up saying that he might sort of get there, but I mean, is he performing as badly as you say in view of the other assessments of him? Because if he were, you would expect not only the party vote to be down, but his own vote to be substantially down rather than Anthony Albanese getting closer to him by moving up. And then
I know this sounds very negative. That sounded very negative about Morrison. I actually think that he's somebody who connects very well with Australians. But what has started to filter through is just this sense that he is not doing the job that he should be. I don't think that makes him a worse alternative in many people's minds than Albanese, who is also not sort of showing any reason to vote for him. There is also a likability factor, simply. You know, if you were, it depends. So women tend not to like Morrison as much. I'm sort of developing what I'm thinking of as the carpool test. You know, would you carpool with this guy? And frankly, the answer from most women is no to both of them. You know, maybe that's the answer to the question that that journalists ask at every election, which is, would you have a beer with this guy? And the answer is, you probably have a beer with Morrison, but Albanese looks like he'd be a bit dull. So, you know, from a popularity perspective, things just work differently in the electorate. And of course, nobody's paying attention until right before the campaign. It's just us who are paying attention now. These are the things, though, that I think are sort of starting to filter through, which start building a perception in people's minds. Everything can be turned around. As Aaron said, the budget's coming up and everything can change.
Well, so you two can just come back here and we'll ask questions. So here we don't know much about carpooling, but we're tops on bicycle pooling. So we're all very fashionable here. So Dimitri Burnshard asks, so what do both of you, what are your expectations for the minor parties?
Do you have a view on that, Parnell?
Dimitri wants to hear that the Liberal Democrats are going to do well. I think that they will do well because of the strategic voting bloc that I was talking about.
Look, the fact, I don't know about the minor parties, although I went along to a very strange gathering in my electorate of the new Liberal Party last week, run by the economist Stephen Keane. And I thought the new Liberals, and I thought, oh, well, these are going to be a, you know, stripping, they're going to be on the right, and they're going to be free marketeers, and they're challenging the Liberal Party's drift into, you know, away from its beliefs, and that they were Greens. They were Greens who didn't believe that there was any budget problems, because they were advocates of modern market theory. So they believed you could print money and fund everything, and they were going to open all the borders and let every refugee stay, and a free university education for everyone. And it was quite something to sit in this room and sort of listen or live in an alternative policy universe. And I say good on them, you know. Let them put their views to the electorate and see if people buy it.
The great thing about modern monetary theory is if you print enough money, you can burn it, and then you've got a renewable fuel source.
Well, and their lead Senate candidate lives in Thailand too. I thought that was strange.
Now, questions in the room, let me know. Now, Aaron also asked to you. Dimitri also asked to you, Aaron, about your, I assume he thinks, is obsessive writing in the Fin Review about the Woolworths at Mossman. And in view of your interest in the Woolworths at Mossman, have you got any idea about the price of bread and the price of milk?
Look, I can confirm that the price of bread is $5 to $7 a loaf at my local Woolworths, which when I had a discussion with Angus Taylor about, he was disgusted. He said his voters pay... his constituents pay $3 for white loaves of bread at Coles. So I guess that shows how out of touch we are here in the inner cities.
That's why you need a Woolworths.
Look just, for those of you, which probably most of you who don't know, I've been waging a campaign over the last few years against the suburb of Mossman. And that's because there's people there insistent on opposing the opening of a Woolworths on Military Road.
Yeah.
And look, and I've turned it into a bit of a joke, and aided by some fantastic submissions to the Mossman Council, one resident saying, we'll just become like Double Bay, full of hairdressing salons and real estate agents. But there's a more important point here, which is the fragmentation of local government across Sydney allows privileged suburbs to essentially hold off or preserve themselves for their own wealthy residents. And so while we're, as a consequence, we're pushing property development, the creation of housing to Liverpool or little areas like Pacific Highway in Crow's Nest So instead of having, I think, a fair and equitable distribution of new housing development across the city, we're having it concentrated in certain suburbs. And so there's very privileged suburbs, such as Mossman, which has a beach, it has a national park, and it has a zoo, and probably some good schools, essentially stops the construction of middle class housing, which I actually think is a complete disgrace.
Question here.
A question to both of you.
And Matthew Abbott has his hand.
No, I'm running this.
Sorry, I apologise.
This isn't the control.
Preferential treatment.
Yeah, so we're going.
The speakers
this
are getting
way.
Uppity.
Okay.
What was interesting was the essential poll, which is usually favourable to Labor, the Guardian published, shows that the polls are all over the place because it shows a much closer gap between Coalition and Labor. That was today. But as I see it, the real problem for the Prime Minister has been that in 2.5 years, or 2 years, he hasn't been the one in charge. And there's nothing to have allowed him to do that. The states have been running the country. And every morning we wake up and we wait for the state health minister, an unelected individual, to tell us our future, to tell us whether we'll be locked up, to tell us what we need to do to live our lives for X number of weeks or months. Now, you know both that under the Constitution, there is nothing the federal government can do about health, policing, education, very much. So we've all been in so-called lockdown. We've been abducted by the state governments, many of which are Labor governments. So what does the federal government do? It can't do anything. So what we're doing right now is we're blaming the Prime Minister for what has been, in fact, enacted upon us by the state premiers. And I don't know if I were Prime Minister how I would have handled it. Now, you could say we shouldn't have had a national cabinet. Well, if he'd gone to war with the states, it wouldn't have been very good either. Hitler couldn't manage war on two fronts. Imagine war on seven fronts plus a couple of territories. So to what extent would, it's not just the budget, but opening the borders and some of our pandemic stuff fading into the background, as I talk to people, they're not thinking about COVID like they used to. They're just angry. With the regulations, how do you see this changing the way in which politics will be argued to the election?
Okay, a couple of quick responses. Yep.
Is that
Aaron?
To me? Okay. Look, I agree with you 100%, Anne. She's just left the room if you're out there in digital land. No, she's back now.
No, she's delivering the microphone to the person you've called.
Sorry, I apologise.
The person you've called improperly.
They play it tough here at the Sydney Institute. No, to your point, which is an excellent one, about the inability of the Prime Minister to control the situation. To me, there's a really important point here, which is the Prime Minister was asked last week if he was going to apologise for going on holidays to Hawaii during the bushfires. Now, that holiday was a matter of no policy consequence. It was purely a matter of perception, and that's obviously a legitimate issue. Whether he should apologise, or would that make people happy? Would it change anything? Clearly, he'd made a political mistake. During the pandemic, he engaged with the premiers, some of them extremely politically hostile to him, without rancor for 2 full years. Okay, he watched Melbourne have the longest lockdown, we're told, in the world. Something which was sapping his coffers to the extent of billions of dollars a week. Okay, and he through his own political discipline, maintained cordial relationships with all the premiers. There was no federal state bust up. And if there had have been, he wouldn't have been asked in the National Press Club, why are you going to apologise for Hawaii? He would have been saying, aren't you a failure? Haven't you shown incredible failure as a national leader because of the war we've had between, you know, isn't this the failure of the Federation and isn't it your fault? And he will never get credit for that. But that, for me, was one of his greatest achievements.
Parnell?
Yes and no. I mean, I think that he can be rightly criticised for not taking a stronger stance with the states when they made questionable decisions on behalf of their citizens. So I know, once again, the polls showed that everybody really liked being locked down for months and months, and that WA still loves it. But there is a reason that you have layers of leadership in a country. You know, we're not asking the Prime Minister to simply accept decisions that the states make. He has the ability and the power to challenge them. And also, you know, one of the things that we found in the pandemic was that our legal system was not capable of taking a challenge and running that so that people who felt that perhaps what was happening was unacceptable could have that tested in court. The legal system again and again said, oh no, hang on, curfews, they're just part of a group of measures that might be helping against infections, and so therefore we're going to accept those whole as bolus. Now, the Prime Minister in that situation, and I know I'm asking an awful lot, but that's what we do when we elect officials. We ask an awful lot of them. The Prime Minister in that situation might have been a better leader if he had said, okay, we need to examine this process. We need to also put on the table at what stage we think that the emergency powers really have to end. Like, I think that New South Wales probably took a greater leadership role vis-a-vis its health officials than the Prime Minister took vis-a-vis the states. So.
Now, we're going to finish in about 15 minutes. We've got to be brief. There's a question down the back.
Hello. Thanks, Dr. Henderson. Matthew Abbott's my name. I just wanted to ask about the likelihood of a hung parliament. And given that all the independents that are running in normally safe Liberal seats, the independents funded by Simon Holmes of Court, given the experience last time with a hung parliament where there was Tony Windsor and Rob Oakeshott, who are parliamentarians who were normally in safe Conservative seats and are now, have returned to safe Conservative seats, what is your sense of the likelihood that we might get some independents in these seemingly safe Liberal seats, and would they be inclined to support the government?
I think Aaron's probably more closer to these.
So the question is, to what extent would independents in what have traditionally been safe Liberal seats be inclined to support a coalition government?
Very little.
Very little, Aaron.
Well, look, just on your first point, the polling I've seen shows the independents are doing very well. That in Goldstein, this is a poll that Tim Wilson, the incumbent Liberal member, bitterly disputes, but the polling I saw by Raffaella Cosby shows them winning, shows Zoe Daniel winning, the ATLIX ABC journalist. Just as an aside to that, I've written a story this afternoon saying that within the Liberal Party, a new candidate has emerged to challenge Zali Steggall in Warringah. Her name is Catherine Deaves, and she is a campaigner against transgender athletes competing against women.
Very nice.
I know someone who was at a private fundraiser, attended by about 30 people and the Prime Minister late last year, and he said Scott Morrison, unprompted, started talking about the prospect of a hung parliament and started rattling through each of the independents and rating how amenable they would be to negotiations with the government. The implication being that is at the forefront of his mind.
There's a question here, then we'll take one from Zoom.
Yeah, hello, good evening, thank you. As a foreign observer, I'm sort of surprised that foreign policy doesn't figure in any of these considerations. I mean, I've been here for a couple of years now, and there was a tremendous shift in foreign policy. You're putting enormous amounts of money into military. You're trashing your main trade partner for all kinds of things. Is there such a consensus among Australians about this, or is foreign policy not part of the political discussion for the elections?
So why is there not much debate on foreign policy?
Because big things in foreign policy swing elections, and the electorate cares about it. In a compulsory system of compulsory voting, where everybody has to vote, a lot of people vote who don't think about foreign policy and don't spend much time even looking at what's happening. So you could say there is a big threat from China and we're going to do something about it, and that might be a reason people would vote on. but the Australians generally are not super engaged in foreign policy, and because they all have to vote, it doesn't become a huge issue at the election. I can go on and on and on whinging about that, but that's for another time.
Aaron, you want to add to that? Okay, so I'll take one from here and then we'll go there. There's a question here, fairly similar, but the recent opposition to Morrison, to the Prime Minister, concerning the tech story, has it led substantially to a perception of disunity in the government, or is it just some fleeting thing that will pass?
The texts?
Yeah.
Well, what does everyone think of the text? Has anyone not heard of the texts? So, the real danger of these is that they play into the Labor narrative, which is that Scott Morrison can't be trusted, that he's a fundamentally dishonest person. Now, I've looked, and I spoke to Malcolm Turnbull about this, and he said they've written books about how dishonest Scott Morrison is. But that was Bernard Keane from Crikey. So, not exactly an unbiased view, but that is the narrative that the Labor Party are going to try and build over the next 4 months. You can't trust Scott Morrison. Now, I can't sense that he's any more or less dishonest than any politician, including that on the Labor side. But of course, they have given such great material, and so that's the political danger in that.
I honestly don't think they're going to cut through that much, though. So, I mean, I think that everybody in the press gallery is talking about it because everybody's got a theory about who it was. And so everybody in this kind of gathering is obsessed, but nobody out in the electorate. I have a test case in my office. She's, from the Shire. She doesn't really, not really engaged in politics. Her task is every morning to come in and report anything that was said of a political nature in her circles. And I threw to her the other day and I said, the text messages. She's like, the what? So I don't believe it's got anywhere near cutting through.
There's a question here. Speaking to the microphone.
It was a very convenient PVO distraction for his own journalist becoming the news story that day. But is the disaster for Australian politics that we only have three-year terms, the 1980s referendum failing, so that we just can't have major reform at all in such short terms?
Quite probably. When was the last major structural economic reform in Australia? Was it the GST? Has there been anything since the GST? Rudd gave it a go in terms of health funding, Commonwealth state health funding.
Well,
just had a comment here. You were part of that cabinet, right?
Well, I was
going to
say education funding.
Do you mean Gonski or pre Gonski?
Well, I wouldn't call it Gonski, but the model we have now.
Yeah, well, that's look, and that's a great look. I guess I'm trying to say is to the education sector that was an incredible boost, incredible investment. Others on the right may question whether it's had much practical effect, but...
The point is it's a national model, whereas there wasn't one previously. There are now jurisdictional agreements around how we deal with funding of education.
And I guess also the NDIS too.
Well, the NDIS is a good one too.
Yes, but these are primarily, dare I say it, funding reforms. They weren't taking money away from anyone, We weren't making it easy to build Woolworths outlets or apartment buildings.
And of course, as you know, it requires a referendum change to go to beyond 3 years, and I don't think anyone thinks a referendum on that would ever get up. So there's a question here.
Yeah. Thank you. Considering your answer to the independent question, the current House, Labor has 68, if you give them the seat of Hawke in Victoria, 69, and in 77, that's 8 seats without any loss themselves. You're saying the independents are strong. Is that a bridge too far for Labor to have to get 8 seats without any loss themselves?
Well, who knows, though? Who knows? Like, we've got 4 months, there's four points in it. You've got to expect they'll narrow, right? But it won't be a uniform swing. Like, who would have guessed in 2019 that Labor's promise to subsidise an AFL football team in Hobart would deliver a swing to the coalition in northern Tasmania. Because all Tasmanians hate those arrogant buggers in Hobart. Like, it's just so hard to tell, okay?
Okay, so...
You've got
to live there to understand that one.
You're in Launceston, you live in Launceston.
I've lived in Hobart and Launceston.
Yeah, so I thought they'd win seats in Launceston, in northern Tasmania. And I think, to some extent, the election will be decided there, because that's where it was decided last time. People think it was decided in Queensland. It was actually decided in northern Tasmania, where the coalition had a chance of winning three seats and lost a candidate and won two. They could have won Lyons, but the candidate had to resign before the poll because of improper texting and whatever. So now I think we're about to finish. There's a question here which I don't really like journalists talking about journalism, but one of our people on the call has asked us about the Canberra press gallery and when is it going to work out that it's got a massive bias problem. So you can end up talking about your colleagues. Let's start with you, Aaron, because...
I was hoping to start with Parnell on that one, too.
Well, she's not a full-time journalist. Come up. But the Fin Review has written about this, haven't they? I mean, the Fin Review editorialised about the Prime Minister's appearance at the National Press Club, didn't it?
Yeah, look, I argued in the paper that despite its ideological divides, the press gallery likes to reach a form of internal consensus about where politics is going. And that forms a sort of a self-preservation mechanism, because if they get it wrong, they get it collectively wrong. And at the moment, I'm convinced, they're all convinced, that Albanese is winning. And I think they probably follow public opinion with a little bit of a lag. But things can turn, okay? So, look, I think to the more substantive point, look, if you choose to come and be journalists, these days you're doing it often because you're fascinated by public policy. You probably started out wanting to contribute to society. And so it's not surprising that there's a more natural tendency amongst political journalists to believe in government as a solution as opposed to a problem. And I don't think that will ever change. What I would love to see is greater neutrality in political reporting. I would love to see a situation where even if you're a left-wing journalist on The Guardian, you write news stories in which it's impossible for the reader to determine or guess your political leanings.
You want to add to that, Verna?
Oh, look, I mean, I was tempted to say that it's because in order to be a journalist these days, you have to be post-material. It doesn't pay so well anymore, and the only way that I can afford to be a columnist is by having a full-time job. So there is that. There is sort of, you know, it doesn't select for the kind of people who are perhaps going to be drawn towards the right of politics. But I think also there is a sort of tension in the paper, because people want to read something which confirms their biases in one direction or another. And so, you know, those are the things that get clicks. They like to see a bit of opinion in their writing. We all say that we'd like to see real neutrality in political reporting, but would we? I mean, what are the papers we're buying? What are we actually reading? What are we clicking on and sharing? That's the real question.
Many thanks. Take a seat over. So many thanks to Aaron Patrick and Parnell McGuinness for a stimulating discussion tonight. We'll love to have you back after the election and check out how those predictions went. And I hope you'll do that. And also find out from Aaron whether his book titled Revenge, whether the revenge was successful or not successful. We'll need to find that out too. But for tonight, thanks for a great discussion, and we'll look forward to you returning, and good luck with your comments in the lead up to the election. Thank you.
Thanks, Jeremy. Thank you.